yeah. Some motherfucking soul cast. A little special episode. What up? It's your boy, Not So Young Soul. You know, to those who listen to the podcast or been listening since the beginning, this ever since I've moved to Maine, I've kept up a rigorous schedule of dropping a podcast every 2 weeks, and you know, when I can, I'll put out more than that. And like right now, I'm in a position where I'm about to start stockpiling episodes, so I was kind of saving this because I did a couple interviews on this subject on other podcasts. And was hoping to compile them all into one, but the other one hasn't come out yet, so I'm just going to drop this one now. As many people know, about a month ago, I dropped a mixtape. It's called Nuclear Winter 3. I wanted to call it White Genocide, but I just wasn't in the mood for that kind of attention. It just seemed like some gimmicky shit to do, but I kind of wish I titled it that. But anyway, so yeah, this is an interview I did with the homies from Coffee with Comrades, and it's a long interview about, I talk about a lot of shit in this interview, but it's mostly about Nuclear Winter 3. Nuclear Winter 3 is a new mixtape that I just dropped. Some people have heard the songs over the years, but it's a free mixtape. You can go to my Bandcamp. You can download it at soul.bandcamp.com, and it's on my website at soul1.org. And you can just get that album for free. And then when you do that, you get put on my newsletter, and that newsletter enables me to like bypass social media and communicate directly with people who fuck with my shit. So this is a great interview. I talk about a lot of stuff that I think is important, but hey, you know, whatever. And and if you dig this podcast, you know, right now the Patreon is basically, you know, clearing about, I don't know, $800 a month after all is said and done, and that's awesome. It's incredible that I get anything for it, but you know, I'm really trying to push this shit further over the next couple years, especially this year. So if you enjoy the podcast and you want to support it, please go over to the Patreon, patreon.com/SOLEONE, and you can sign up. You can sign up for $1 a month, $2 a month, you know, whatever. Anything is appreciated. But, you know, I'm trying to really push this project and do a lot with it. And, you know, right now, could use all the resources that we can get. So, and by we, I mean me and my dog. But yeah, without any more blabbing, we'll get into a trailer from someone in the Channel Zero Podcast Network, and then we'll go ahead with this interview. You can check out Coffee with Comrades online, Google that shit, sign up for their podcast, and if you enjoyed this podcast, give us a shout on social media and let us know.
Too busy trying to survive capitalism's daily grind to get caught up on the latest anarchist news? Or maybe you're so wrapped up in your own organizing that it's hard to make time to hear about other liberatory struggles. This Rebel Girl has got you covered. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes of The Hot Wire, a 30-minute podcast with the latest anarchist news, on-the-ground interviews, a repression roundup, political prisoner birthdays, and announcements for upcoming events. All this and more at crimethink.com.
I just want to say one last thing before I start this interview is I edited it down a little bit. There's about 40 minutes of them talking about current events and stuff at the beginning, and it's been like a month since that interview, so it didn't make a lot of sense to include that. But if you want to hear the full episode, you can go over to their website, check it out. And to everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you. It's been a crazy journey.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town, and the police make it hard wherever I may go, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Coffee with Comrades, a leftist podcast discussing current events, theory, and action through a radical lens. Sometimes shit just fucking sucks, and it has to be just left at that, and that's why we fucking fight, that's why we struggle, that's why we fucking give a shit, is because if not us, who, if not now, when? We can't fucking sit on our hands and wait for, you know, somebody else to save us. We gotta fucking fight. So, we wanted to spend the rest of the day talking with our boy, our friend, our comrade, MC Soul. We talked about a number of great stuff. We talked about his new mixtape, Nuclear Winter 3.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, it's so fucking good. It's so good. If you haven't listened to it, stop what you're doing. Listen to it. Then listen to this podcast. In addition, we talk about permaculture. We talk about the idea of building power and dual power. Soul is a beacon of hope in a dreary world. He's a good dude. Got a good heart, and we're glad that he is a comrade. Grab yourself a cup of coffee and enjoy this interview.
I got Vikings, peasants, immigrants inside my DNA. Bunch of farmers, plumbers, fishermen inside my DNA. I got addiction, stress, anxiety ain't fixed by THC. I've been all around the world and I can't run from USA. Mr. Forest for the trees, too many walls are in the way. White people make me cringe, y'all are fucked up nowadays. Bankrupt education, they can't see the white supremacy. If they do, they either double down or give up agency. Say they're beefing with the cops, the police is KKK.
My name is Tim Holland, aka Soul. I was born in Portland, Maine, hundreds of years ago. And I'm just kind of, I don't know, I'm a rapper, and I started putting out records when I was working at McDonald's at like age 15, and just saved up money and started putting out like independent records and mailing them all around the world. And before the internet was the internet, it was like news groups. I just kind of developed friendships and tape trades with all these people all over North America, and kind of connected with all these other weirdo rapper artists, kind of outsider artists from all over North America. And then we all moved to San Francisco together to form, I think, the first collectively run independent hip hop label in the world, called Anticon Records. And one of our main things was sort of like taking a step away from like what we thought was boring at the time, like where hip hop was very centered around New York City and sort of, you know, just braggadocio kind of backpack rap. And we wanted to make raps that were more like conceptual and poetic and kind of like art projects. And so that's kind of where I kind of how I quote unquote got famous and got a career. And so I did that for a while and then moved to Barcelona for a couple of years and sort of traveled all around. We lived there for a couple of years, moved back, didn't want to live in another alienated, overpriced American city. So we moved to like the Flagstaff area and sort of fell in love with the desert. And out there, I kind of started gardening a little bit, but I was mostly kind of like a Marxist libertarian reading in the woods, kind of getting in touch with my inner Thoreau. And eventually I got bored living out there. And so we decided to move to Denver. We're lucky enough to move there before it was this yuppie hellhole that it is now. And we rented a house downtown, and it was just a really nice place to live and garden. So I just started gardening a lot there and kind of did that for like 9 years and, you know, got into like food forestry and permaculture and just all this other, you know, while liking to study and read. And the cool thing about living in Denver and being so close to downtown was, you know, when Occupy was happening, it was just a couple blocks from my house. And so I was able to really, you know, because I have like a independent, I guess I should also add that I pulled all my music from Anticon about 10 years ago because I didn't like the direction that the business was going in.
What was the direction it was going in, if you don't mind me asking?
Just trendy and kind of people letting this little asshole who became the label manager just sort of running the label into the ground and sort of like not having any respect for the ethics that the label was founded on. And basic treating me like shit, essentially. And I was like, you know what? This shit's making me upset. I started this record label with my money and turned it into a collective. And I'm not going to have something that is supposed to be there to like enable me to do art for the rest of my life working against me. And so I just, after years of going back and forth, I was like, you know, I'm done with this. I'm taking my stuff. And then when I did that, you know, when an artist has like a pretty big and popular back catalog and you don't have a middleman in the middle or middle woman or middle whoever in the middle, and you're just getting direct income, it sort of freed me up in a really big way to kind of, you know, for, you know, I was privileged at that point. I wasn't like rich. I was still working poor, but I had like a steady revenue, so I could just kind of get involved with activism and organizing, you know, and then it just kind of led me into other directions. And so it was, it was cool. So that's kind of like where I'm at. And then after that, I just a couple months ago moved to Maine back home to raise my kid, in a more holistic environment around family. And so we've been here about 2 months. So can't say much about that other than it's beautiful and it's nice to be by the ocean.
Does it feel like you've kind of come full circle?
I don't think so. I hope not. I'm not living in my hometown. I'm living a little north, and this life is very different than what I grew up in. And, we just view it as like another chapter in our adventure.
Fuck yeah, man.
Because we just, you know, we're kind of like nomadic and just like to go around. Like maybe we'll stay here, but you know, maybe we'll move to Taos, New Mexico. Maybe we'll, you know, I don't know. I mean, it seems weird to like think about like a long game permaculture food forest and then like to leave in 5 years, but I don't know. I'm just down for whatever, you know. It's like, for me, like doing it and thinking about it, like that's the fun stuff. Like I almost don't even care about picking fruit, you know?
Well, hey, we wanted to have you on the show to talk about a bunch of different stuff, but first things first, you have a new record coming out, right?
Yeah, actually I have a couple new records coming out, but the first one is, Nuclear Winter. It's a mixtape, comes out at the end of the month.
What made you like decide to stitch together all of these songs into one big ass mixtape? You talk about it briefly on the first track, Smoke Signal, but I was wondering if you could dive into this idea of like the history of mixtapes and then why you chose these particular songs for this particular mixtape.
Well, I mean, I've made Nuclear Winter mixtapes. This is volume 3. and it was really just a joke. I'm really into the Situationists, even though, you know, Guy Debord was definitely a fucking asshole, and I don't think I would like to work with him if he was alive today. But maybe his maybe he'd be more of an anarchist today. So I don't know. But he kind of not didn't seem like a great person.
Sure.
But I really love the idea of detournement or detournement, and basically, you know, what they would do is they'd take a piece of art and then they would quote unquote correct it and invert its meaning. And so take capitalist works and invert the meanings of these things to intervene politically. And, you know, Adbusters stole that idea, or I should say no more than I'm stealing the idea, but Adbusters really ran with that idea and just made it cheesy. You know, like a Nike symbol that says slavery or just, you know, whatever. And so, but you know, there was like a moment where that stuff was cool. And like, it's a generally common practice in art where people do that all the time, you know, take a dollar sign and make it a thing about George Washington being a slave master or something. And so I was listening to Young Jeezy's, my president is black. My president is black. I forget the chorus. And I was like, and I heard like 20 remixes of that song. And I was like, dude, our president is fucking accelerating most of the shit that George Bush did. Yep. And now we're getting used to like targeted assassinations, and like he promised health care and we're definitely not going to get it. And this is fucked up, because I actually, you know, even though I had like whatever, I wouldn't say my anarchist politics were like really dead on back then, but I did think that President Obama was gonna, you know, make some significant changes. I remember like when he was elected, I was like, oh my God, I'm not gonna have anything to rap about anymore. This is terrible. I mean, I really was thinking that. And so I was like, all right, I'm gonna just do a version of this track, kind of calling out his bullshit, you know.
Right on.
And you know, as a white rapper to come out against Obama, like early in his presidency, like people were fucking furious at me, and it was really, you know, it was funny. So anyway, flash forward to Nuclear Winter, and basically, I always wanted to make Nuclear Winter 3, but every time I'd sit down to make it, I, you know, around that same time, DJ Payne 1 and I started collaborating a lot, and so, like, I really, like, when I wanted a, whatever, a mainstream kind of trappy, whatever our music sounds like, if I wanted a beat that had, like, that sort of, you know, clean club aesthetic, I could just get it from him. I didn't have to steal a beat from Lil Wayne anymore.
Right.
And so I just never finished. I never really got to working on it. But what I did do from like from before Occupy all the way through now, is anytime something was happening that I, cause that's how Nuclear Winter started, was there were these direct interventions against something that was happening. And so every time something that was happening that like bothered me or I felt I needed to respond to, I would just make one of these tracks and then just release it and put it up on SoundCloud or on YouTube or something and get my point across. And, you know, because we live in like this social media world, like, you know, I felt like I was able to contribute to the discussion on, you know, through social media and through my outlets and kind of intervene. And so basically what's cool about it is this record marks the before, you know, when I was still like a little bookworm kid, reading and just rapping about philosophy through like my early entry into street activism and organizing all the way through to where I'm at now. And so it's like an interesting, like, you can, if you're listening closely, you can sort of trace like, you know, the political development and sort of how I am kind of like fighting the, you know, killing the liberal that lived in my head, and sort of whatever, wrestling with various ideas, whether it's about capitalism or the apocalypse or the end of the world or gun control or electoral politics or violence and nonviolence. And so when you listen to the record, it sounds like I'm like this hyper partisan maniac. Really, I'm a nice guy, and you know, I
really, guys, I promise, I'm a nice guy.
I don't hate liberals. You know, I have liberal friends. It's all good.
Hey, liberal, you know I love you. I know you mean well, but let's get real. Let's get real. So you wanna make your white guilt go? Why don't you go to Iraq, preach no violence to the army? You call it charity, I call it a feel good. For the walk for motherfuckers who don't know how NGOs spend money. You say we're agent provocateurs, but you're worse. You're an agent moderator, an SEIU plan, a moveforwards.org front group for a bunch of Democrats.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I noticed about this record, is it's like fucking angry. And like, it's like, but it's a righteous anger, and it's the kind of anger that I think we need. And there's actually a lyric from Three Way Fight.
Cruelty. anger.
And I think that that idea of holding on to your anger is really, really important now more so than ever. You know, not losing that sense of outrage. Like, it's really easy to get caught up in being like, oh, well, that's no surprise. It's almost like it's cool to be like, oh, well, I wasn't surprised by that horrible thing that the Trump administration did. Or, oh, I wasn't surprised that, you know, there's a coup attempt in Venezuela that was sponsored by the U.S. Like, I wasn't surprised. It's almost like this, like, you know, haughty, you know, self-aggrandizing thing when we should be, you know, surprised. We should be outraged. We should be irate about, you know, injustice in the world wherever it might rear its ugly head.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is about, like, anger, and I would almost, like, draw a distinction, not to play this game, but we're both poets here. Bri, are you a poet, too? I don't know.
Yeah.
We're all poets here.
Yes.
And so I guess I would maybe even, like, draw a distinction between anger and outrage. And, like, you know, I think anger is like, you know, anger, whereas, like, outrage is, like, pussy hats and sure. clever signs, you know, and ranting on social media. And, like, I feel like in this climate we're in, it's really easy to get desensitized. And, you know, again, we just get, it's like seeing pictures of Guantanamo and seeing pictures of, I don't even think pictures of, you know, starving children moves liberals anymore. I think that, like, I don't think anything, you know, every once in a while, one image breaks through that, like, manages to move people. But, like, are people still moved by the image of the baby that washed up on the beach in Greece when everyone was outraged about Syria? Like, people have forgotten already. Yeah. People don't care anymore. And so, like, these songs were written, like, when all this anger was raw. You know, they were like, it's like that song you're quoting, Three-Way Fight. That was the day after President Trump was elected president, and, like, we were all out in the streets, and we, you know, it was just crazy, because, you know, you had, like, we had like 5,000 people in the streets in Denver, and then, like, some random person no one had ever heard of who just magically disappeared after stealing like $5,000 from people. But basically this magical person who no one had ever heard of managed to create a Facebook event that got 5,000 people out into the streets. And I was supposed to speak at this rally, and of course, every time somebody gives me a megaphone at a rally, I always go against what everyone else said and point to history and point to things happening all over the country and saying, yeah, if you're pissed off, like, don't just be satisfied with this. The highway is that way. Let's go shut it down, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we did, but we had to, like, literally, you know, march around and do this stupid shit with people chanting, like, for Hillary Clinton and
love Trump's hate! Love Trump's hate! Love Trump's hate! Love Trump's hate!
That mantra became so ubiquitous that it became, instead of, like, love is trumping hate, people are loving Trump's hate. And it would just, like, blur together in this, like, weird, obsequious, like, cesspool of nonsense. And it didn't make any sense, and it didn't have any teeth. It didn't have any volition behind it. It was all empty and hollow rhetoric.
Yeah, and again, so after that, I just realized, oh my God, this is going to be way worse than Occupy. Like, this is just, I mean, granted, we did shut the highway down that night, and, you know, but it took, like, a strong anti-capitalist contingent to make that happen, and
right.
It was the first time we ever had, and so it was like, oh my God, I was, like, realizing all the power of these moments, of this moment, and political moment we're in, but then the ignorance of even, like, you know, college graduated liberals who just, you know, see the Arab Spring on TV, but then, like, I don't know. I just don't understand. I mean, I know why. It's because our history in school, it just whitewashes everything. Like, MLK was some waif who just didn't have any courage, and just sort of, I don't know, like, the people's view of history is just totally whitewashed. You know, Rosa Parks just happened to be on the bus.
Right.
And so I guess that, I mean, that's kind of an example of you know, how these songs come about. Like, you know, another one is the song Gun Control.
Fucking Democrats talking about gun control. Ask Anaheim pigs what them guns are for. First thing a dictatorship does, ban guns. First thing a real democracy do, ban drones. I'm a dreamer, wanna live in a world without guns popping. Not a world where only the cops got and wanna know where the U.S. is headed. Look to Greece where immigrants are terrorized by the fascist police. And when the shit hits the fan, they want you helpless, unable to defend yourself against state violence. Fuck that, if you ask me, it ain't about guns. It's about the way we fall beneath the cracks as the world turns. Alienation, hyper-individualism, death of communities, social service systems. Americans are stressed out, more so than the rest of the West.
Like, after Jake Holmes, basically what happened was there's this group called We Are Change, who's like an Alex Jones, before Alex Jones went full fash, was a sort of like, they would be like the libertarian bros at all the protests, you know, chanting about the Fed and 9/11 truth. And the people from the local Colorado chapter spread the rumor to Luke Radowski and that whole world that that person was a member of the Denver Anarchist Black Cross. And so all these, and so we were just pissed off. I'm not a member of the Anarchist Black Cross, but my good friends were.
Right.
And it's just like, oh my God, if you're like, they always want to pin these killers on, and now they say Antifa, but back then it was like, they wanted to like attach it to the anarchists. And the reason why that's dangerous is like, in Denver, there was a pretty strong culture of like, you know, armed self-defense mentality of like, you know, like a gun club. And actually a lot of like the John Brown gun club stuff kind of got started in Denver in a lot of ways. And so I was just like so pissed off that anybody would link this mass killer to the work that my friends were doing. And so I just made this song. But also just talking about like, you know, like gun control, like, you know, people always point to gun control as if we just took away the guns, all the other problems would disappear. And this was before I'd interviewed Franco Berardi, but I had this idea that alienation and just the hyper atomized society was what was really causing people to do these things. You know, if you look at, you know, like you didn't, when people were living communal lives or, you know, egalitarian or, you know, whatever, indigenous peoples of the world, like they weren't going out with bows and arrows or knives and just randomly killing all their neighbors. Like that's not a natural thing for human beings to want to do. I believe, you know, that our civilization produces these things, and we're not going to just legislate that away. We're going to have to really reimagine our whole way of life. And so when people are just talking about gun control, you know, I just feel like it's ridiculous. And so, because most of my quote unquote fan base are liberals, quote unquote, I wanted to make a song that sort of addressed that and spoke to that and said, hey, look, like, your uncle has a semi-automatic AR-15 in his basement. He doesn't do that, you know, like, come on. And also the idea is like rap is journalism, and like the idea that I can, because I'm not patient enough to write an article, but I am one of these people who can make a song really fast and insert some analysis into it.
I especially appreciated the gun control track because, I mean, we've done an episode on this on Coffee with Comrades about sort of our point of view on kind of the state of the gun control debate. And like you, I also have, you know, liberal friends, and it seems to be a particular point of contention between myself and my liberal friends, especially when it comes to, you know, talking about things like, you know, being able to arm yourself and defend your family and your community. And as I really, really appreciated it, I thought it was very it was very timely and appropriate. Like, I really, really enjoyed that track, and so I'm with you.
Yeah, and I mean, the only thing I will say, just to add a little nuance, is like, you know, I don't really think we need to have fully automatic AR-15s. If the government banned those, I don't care. You know, go for it. But you know, like, I don't care. I'm not gonna, I'm not going to push for that. I'm not going to advocate for that. I'm not going to say it's a good idea. But I'm willing to, like, stand aside on, like, these high-powered, crazy guns that really have no use but to, you know, kill a bunch of people. Anybody who needs a machine gun to hunt deer, like, you probably shouldn't be hunting because you're not – it's probably not going to taste very good after you kill them.
No, I can't imagine it would.
No, those weapons are not super practical.
No, definitely not. Can you talk a bit about the history and the inspiration of King of New York? Because the satire on that track in particular is hysterical, and the story behind it is pretty funny as well.
The stock exchange, that's the only real king in New York. Bloomberg got the third biggest army on earth. Where the hell is Compton? Just another place where cops will kill blacks. Fuck the pock and big talk, you ain't battling cops. All of your bases are belonging to us, and dollars we trust. Whether the name of Jesus, Buddha, Allah, we bust. Down through the walls, world's empires have failed. The gift shop at the end of history, wall up for sale. I ain't the king of New York, I'm the king of the earth. My kingdom is space, wherever there's ATMs or Columbus is space. Don't give a fuck about Kendrick Lamar. I'm digging the graves, subjugated the planet to all of my whims. Patriarchal society, all of my sons. And this city's just a border that you ain't even draw. First I'll sell you a noose and then charge you for a grave. You might be thinking you're free, but I am your DNA.
King of New York was Kendrick Lamar did a song where he's like rapping over some beat, and I forget what it was. And on the track, he says, "I'm the king of New York."
I don't smoke crack, motherfucker, I sell it.
Bitch, everything I rap is a quarter piece to your melon. So if you have a relapse, just relax and pop in my disc. Don't you pop me the fucking pill, I'ma pop you, then give me this.
Tail flex to drop a bomb on this shit. So many bombs ring the alarm like Vietnam on this shit. So many bombs make Farrakhan think that's a dime in this bitch. One at a time, I line them up and bomb on their mom when she watching the kids. I'm in a destruction mode if the gold exists. I'm important like the Pope. I'm a Muslim on poke. I'm Machiavelli's offspring. I'm the king of New York, king of the coast. One hand, I juggle them both.
You know, which really pissed a lot of people off. And so this dude, Static Selecta, who makes beats for Jay-Z, and who actually I knew when he was like a, I don't know, like a 15-year-old kid in Exeter, New Hampshire, anyway. But that was just like, I didn't even realize those two were the same people until this track came out. And so he, cause he's like a, you know, a big New York DJ and producer. And so he made this beat called The King of New York, and was like, hey, if any New York rappers feel a certain way about what Kendrick said, like spit your hottest 16s. And I was like, all right. And this was like, you know, after Occupy Wall Street, and I was like, I'm going to just make a song about how, you know, the city is just a border that no one drew, and how silly it is to rep for a city, and how, as we're all talking all this shit on these corporate media platforms, these platforms are owned by these major financial interests, and Wall Street is actually the king of New York, and capitalism is the king of New York. And so I wanted to make a song as Wall Street, kind of repping for, you know, Wall Street, stand up, you know, like I'm Wall Street, I'm the king of New York. So that's where that's the inspiration for that song. And yeah, that was just, you know, me trying to be funny.
It is funny. It is absolutely hilarious. So well fucking done, my friend. Well done. We were talking a little bit earlier about the difference between anger and outrage. And I'm curious, you know, you've been in this fight for a while now. And I'm curious, like, How do we hold on to our anger and use it for positive insurrectionary change while, like, avoiding burnout? Because I know that's a thing that a lot of folks who are involved in community organizing struggle with. They go super hard and then they burn out. And I know that, you know, the discussions about self-care have been circulating more and more recently. And I'm just curious, like, how do you see us using our anger in a positive way and not getting so exhausted that we just abandon the fight altogether?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, something Scott Crow would always say. I consider Scott Crow like a mentor. He's like one of these people I call up all the time when I'm like confused or frustrated over the years. And he's always patient enough to deal with me. And you know, at times I've felt that way and I've been like, man, I just can't do this anymore. And he's like, then don't, you know, don't. He's like, just fucking, you know, if you're whatever, he would use the term emergency heart. Like if your emergency heart isn't beating right now, isn't calling you to do something, then just don't. Like go play video games, do whatever.
Yeah.
And one of the things that this is a really tough thing to do. But there are a lot of times what happens when I'm organizing, I often feel like, how come other people are not working as hard as me? How come, you know, I say I'm going to be here at this time and I'm the only one, 20 of us agree to be at this one place and then no one else shows up. And I'm like, what are we doing? You know? And so a lot of times, or the other thing will happen where there's just so much going on and I'm, you know, kind of losing my mind or something. And you get swept up in like the adrenaline and the insanity. And like those things come in waves. And so a lot of times when I'm feeling like I'm losing it or whatever, I just stop. I just take a step back and like do the minimal upkeep. And like my thinking around it is like, if this is a value, then there should be more people who are willing to step up to do this. And if it is not of value, then people won't. And just because like I'm in the middle of something and I feel like it's life or death and the whole world is hinging upon, not really, but like
it feels like that at times. Yeah.
Yeah. But then when you stop doing it and then no one else steps up to do it, it's like, well, shit, if no one else is stepping up to do it, then maybe that means it wasn't of value. Maybe I need to reevaluate, you know? And like I know on my mixtape, I kind of diss Zizek, but one of the things that I really liked that Zizek said on an interview, I believe it was on Democracy Now, maybe 10 years ago, where I discovered him, where people were asking him like, what should we do right now? And he's like, don't do anything, just think, you know? And like, it's like right now, like I have like survivor's guilt from like leaving Denver and, you know, all the gentrification and just all this terrible things happening there to like live in this idyllic farm. You know, it's a time for like reflection and thinking and like reimagining praxis. And if we just continue like to bash our heads against a brick wall and like just doing it out of like because we're bored, because our personal lives are boring, because we have like unresolved childhood trauma. And so we just like rail against this thing that's way bigger than us. And like, you know, our dad becomes the state or whatever, that's not healthy. And so it's really important to, you know, but then on the other hand, it's really important to like acknowledge those patterns and to like, look at like, our behavior and how we're thinking and how we're feeling. And like, if all those things aren't clicking up, then something's wrong. And that's when like you need to take a step back. And so for me, it's been really important over the last few years to like step back and like recharge and just be like, no, I don't feel like doing shit right now. I don't feel like I have to let somebody else step up. And right. The good thing about that is like, you know, sometimes like, you know, I have a really strong personality and like, sure. I try to like, you know, check my male white privilege and not like dominate rooms and not and like step back. And, you know, I've done a lot of work around that stuff because as a performer, I can just blab and, you know, control rooms essentially. And so it's like, and so it's good to like allow space for other people to step up and do stuff and not to feel like, you know, what you're doing or your involvement is so important because it's good to let other people step up. It's good to step back. It's good for people to see, oh, wait, that group of people is bitter now. They're not doing anything anymore. I guess it's time for us who's been kind of waiting on the sidelines to step up. And the last thing I would say is like, you know, I have a really healthy home life. Like I'm, you know, I've been with my wife. We met in like 2001 and, you know, we have through most of this time, we have dogs and gardening and, you know, every day we cook a nice meal. And, you know, I have like these grounding practices. And I think it's like if your entire identity and social life is wrapped up in your activism, there are some dangers with that, especially if like the people you're surrounding yourself with are comrades only, and like you don't friends. Have any, yeah, and not friends. Mm-hmm. Cause like, if you can't go, if there's not some people who you like really want to like drink a beer with after, or have some tea or go for a bike ride with, then like eventually all those projects are not going to lead to what you want to lead to, yep. because you're not developing real friendships, and like, you can't force that stuff.
Yeah, man. That's so fucking true.
That is very true.
Yeah. And then the last thing I would say is like, you know, just like the self-care stuff can also be a dead end. Like, there are groups that just spend their whole time just self-care this, self-care that, self-care. And it's like if all you do, and I mean, granted, there are groups like dedicated to self-care, and that's important. But I mean, like, activist groups that are like supposed to be railing against police brutality, but they end up just doing self-care all the time. It's like, well, then don't call yourself that. Call yourself the walking and talking circle. You know, exercising, you know, like, anytime I feel crazy, I just look at what's going on in my life. Am I exercising enough? Am I smoking too much weed? Have I gained weight because I'm eating too many carbs? Like, am I spending too much time inside when I should be out around human beings? Like, when was the last time I hiked? And like, some people don't even develop those interests, you know, and those interests that bring us closer to the earth are going to be the most grounding. Like, you know, just walking around barefoot on the grass once a month could do wonders for you, you know. And so for everybody else, it's different, you know. But I think it's like, it should be a part of everybody's revolutionary strategy of like, how do I feel? If you don't feel right, then you need to reevaluate what you're doing, because you're not going to be able to help others if all you're doing is being stressed out and angry all the time. Like, you're not going to last long as an activist, and B, we're not prefiguring the world we want. Mm-hmm. And C, you know,
yeah,
fill in the blanks, whatever.
You know, yeah, man.
You're going to burn out.
Don't want no residents to represent me. 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 I'm out for every open residents to represent me.
Well, speaking of prefiguration, you do a lot of work around gardening and permaculture and food autonomy, and we would be remiss if we didn't spend some time exploring some of those subjects that you've dug into on the Soulcast quite regularly with. So if it's cool with you, we wanted to pick your brain for a bit as well.
Awesome. I'll tell you what I know, what little that is.
So you mentioned you and your family recently relocated from Denver to a farm in Maine. How has that been for y'all? Y'all settling in all right?
I mean, I'll be honest, it was like kind of traumatic, you know, because we originally, when we moved out here, we were just going to rent, and like rentals were like so expensive. It's crazy. Like, there's no rental properties here because of Airbnb, and just, it's just not that kind of place. And so like, rents are the same here as they are in Denver, actually. So we were looking at like, you know, buying like a fixer upper, and I'm not like the most mechanically inclined person. So basically, how has it been? So my mom checked out this house for us and looked at it and sent us photos, and she's like, you know, we found this house online and it looked cool. It's near a river and a pond, and you know, an acre and a half. And so and it was a foreclosure, so it was like super cheap. And so my mom came out and looked at it, and she was like, oh my God. She's like, you know, this place needs some work, but you guys, this is it. This is an amazing place for you. So we hadn't even seen it. We just saw the photos my mom sent, bought the house, and moved in. And, you know, when we get here, you know, it was like basically from like April through June when we moved, May through July, whatever it was, I hadn't really been able to work for like 3 months, just packing up our whole life. Was just a lot of work, and it was stressful. Yeah. And I was sad to leave my friends, because I have like really good friends in Denver, and so does she. And so when we got here, it was like we're in the middle of the woods, and we don't really have friends here that we know. And it was like hot, and you know, we get to this house and like the furnace had blown up, the roof was dilapidated, all the water, no one had lived in this house for 2 years, all the water pipes had burst, you know, the entire back was just completely overgrown with brush and goldenrod, and you know, getting these like deer tick nymphs on us that carry Lyme disease
that,
that like you can barely even see. Yeah. And so like that's the negative side. And, right. And it's like, and you know, and for us, like, I don't know how to build stuff. I, you know, I'm like having to rely on my uncle who's a cousin and my mom's boyfriend who is helping with this and that. And so it's like really overwhelming when you get into a situation like that. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to get back to work. I can't afford to like just navel gaze and play with nails and screws all summer. I have to make money. Like I didn't save up mm-hmm. 20 grand to do this. Like I'm paycheck to paycheck. I'm Patreon check to royalty check over here. And so like that for me was really stressful. And then also like looking out onto the land, like, oh my God, our dream home is here. And here we are with all this land. And I'm like, oh my God, what do I do now? Like, how do I clear this land? How many trees do I plant? Like how, you know, and so all these other like, you know, but it's just, you got to take things one step at a time. And that, I mean, that's the negatives. I mean, the positive is that it's like, we have three times more space in our house than we've ever had. Like our son is loving it. Like it's beautiful. Like our porch is so beautiful. Like we hang out and drink coffee and watch these birds, and there's bald eagles flying over. And, you know, me and my son, there's like this pond next to us that has like a lifeguard at it, and me and my son just go over there and go swimming. And it's like, you know, and being near family and being near the ocean, it's like a dream, but it's a dream that we're really having to work for.
Right.
And so it's like, it's the combination of two, so it feels it's amazing, and like we love it, and like in many ways we're happier than ever. But on the other hand, you know, when you take on a project like this, it requires a whole new level of mental gymnastics, you know, mm-hmm. levels of stress and just taking it easy and one thing at a time. So it's good. It's, I mean, I definitely don't, I love it here, but you know, I also don't want to make it sound like, oh, my life is a dream and it's so easy. It's like, no, actually, right. It's a lot of challenges and we're working through them, but it's, you know, if you, nothing in this life is free. If you want something good, you better be willing to work for it.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that answer, just because I'm a month away from getting married myself, and my partner and I were kind of, you know, we don't want to rent an overpriced apartment in a very dirty, very hot, very overcrowded city anymore. So we're kind of on the verge of what I feel like is going to be a similar sort of shift. And while I like to think we're doing kind of a similar thing, where we're looking at like a lot of fixer uppers and, you know, houses that need like tons and tons of work. And I like to think I'm handy, but it definitely, like, doing more research and learning more about what we're actually would be getting ourselves into, the romanticized kind of, you know, idyllic vision sort of wears away. And it's like, oh, this actually takes a lot of hard work and mental fortitude for sure. So I really appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, you know, good luck. And I mean, one thing I would say is like the reason why I also think it's a good reason, a good thing to do is, I shouldn't say good thing to do, but it's like people might say, oh, you know, that's not a good investment, you know, but it's like, actually there's a huge,
we've gotten that a lot,
but there's this huge trend of like, hipsters taking their, handlebar mustaches to the woods and,
right.
gentrifying the rural areas now. And so like people are realizing that the cities are going to shit, and there's this, you know, a bulk of the economic
Exodus.
Output. Yeah, a bulk of the economic output happening now is like from the artistic class in rural areas as opposed to farming and or what they call creatives. And so I feel like, you know, even from an economic standpoint, it's not a bad investment to live like that, because more and more people are doing it, and so it's better to do it now before it's cool, before it's too cool for school.
Right. And yeah, I think, you know, like for us, it definitely comes from more of a, you know, obviously, like I'm really interested in a sort of food autonomy and that sort of thing, and that level of independence that kind of comes with leaving a city for sure. But one of the things that people, like, I keep hearing, like, every time that I kind of have talked about this with some of my fellow millennials or whatever, their first response is like, well, what about the termites? And I'm like, well, what about the termites?
Right.
Like, they all kind of jump to that sort of like, oh, it's a bad idea. But anyway, so what we really want to dig into here is food autonomy. We did a food episode on our podcast not too long ago that we're really proud of, but we didn't talk about permaculture at all, actually. So if you could, for our listeners, just kind of give us like a brief definition of what permaculture is.
You get a different answer from different people you ask, depending on how much Kool-Aid they've drank. I would just say permaculture is like this methodology of gardening or farming that sort of uses the natural processes of the earth and kind of mimics what nature does to gain maximum yield from your land while having to put the minimal inputs in. At least that's the basic idea. And so there are basic concepts of permaculture, like within the problem lies the solution, you know, the smallest change for the greatest impact, you know, and I love that stuff. And so basically what they take practices from, you know, indigenous people from all over the world, like the most famous sort of permaculture guild. A guild is like a series of vegetables and plants and herbs and trees that go well together. Like the most famous guild that people know about is the Three Sisters, which is an excellent demonstration of like permaculture at work. Basically, you plant corn, squash, and beans together. The corn grows up straight and produces corn and provides a pole for the bean to climb up of. Beans produce nitrogen into the soil. They fix nitrogen from the air and put it into the soil, and then that nitrogen fertilizes the corn, and it fertilizes the squash, and then the squash grows along the ground, blocking out weeds and retaining moisture. And so that's what Native Americans or indigenous people of North America did, was the Three Sisters, and that's a really cool example of permaculture. I mean, other examples of permaculture, like digging, like slowing the water flows and storing water flows in certain places so that you don't have to water your garden or farm as much. You know, like one permaculture idea that I was kind of already doing, but I made more of a science of it after I studied it a lot, was like these idea of zones. Like you have zone one is like the area that's the closest to your house. Zone two is the next area out. And so the things that require the most care and attention and that you need the most, you put in zone one. And so I always like to have like a perennial herb garden right by my kitchen, and a salad bed right by my kitchen. And so an example of like a cool permaculture salad bed would be like you know, a row of spring onions, and all spring onions are perennial if you just cut them. And if you're in Florida, everything is perennial, I'm sure. and, you know, you just plant a row of onions, and then you plant a row of lettuce, and then you plant a row of spinach. And then, like, maybe you have, like, chicory and some more rare salad greens, depending on where you grow. And you just, like, you mix up your crops so that you're not planting these huge monocrops, but you're like, you're confusing the bug. So like one bug might really like your kale, but then it'll stop on that row of kale and not go over the lettuce and the onions. And you can do things like plant dill, fennel, nasturtium flowers on like your periphery to attract beneficial insects, which will also take care of aphids, which were a huge problem for me in Denver. And so like, you know, and then like I'll put a row of fava beans or pole beans along the back to fix nitrogen in the soil, and you know, use the elevation of that's in a way that it doesn't block out the sun for the other plants. And so, I mean, you can just go on and on and on, but you're basically mimicking natural systems. And it's really, you know, I think of like the saying, don't be a tree that bends with the wind, be a fern that that bends with the wind. Don't be a tree that breaks with the wind, be a fern that bends. And so you look at like what's growing in your area, and like maybe there's ways to hack things to, you know, to like push the limits. But at a certain point, it's like if you're living in Tucson, maybe you don't want to grow broccoli because it's just going to get cooked by the sun. There are a lot of the vegetables that are part of our diet, all 20 of them. They're mostly crops that grow in temperate climate zones along sea level, like broccoli, cabbage, like brassicas, which those don't grow well in the high desert. So in the high desert, you're going to be growing a lot of squash and shit like that. So, and if people are curious about, if people are curious about permaculture, I would say pick up the book Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemingway, and it will really just blow your mind if you're interested in learning about this stuff, because it just cracked my brain open and got me pumped. So I would suggest others do the same.
That's awesome. So speaking of sort of indigenous folks, what do you think that anarchists and leftists of all stripes can learn from indigenous groups, especially when it comes to things like gardening?
I mean, that's part of like my beef with permaculture, is that it's very white. And what they can learn is that a lot of the ideas that we're using have been around for thousands of years, and they weren't invented by well-meaning liberals in college towns. They were invented by indigenous people.
Are you saying that white people steal things from people of color constantly?
As a white rapper, I'll plead the fifth on that. But, you know, I mean, other things that they could learn are, you know, I mean, the most basic thing is that this whole continent is stolen. And, you know, as I just had a podcast with Zoe Simuzzi, and we were talking about, or she was talking about how if any time you're thinking about a land project, you know, that's like based around revolutionary ideas or liberation, you have to consider the long history of that place and who was there. And who's still around. And in Brunswick, we're lucky to have these like indigenous women do this like weekly or biweekly thing at the library, where they just sort of, you know, just talk about the history and what they're doing. One book I read by this woman, Robin Kimmerer, I think, it's called Braiding Sweetgrass. And she is I don't remember what tribe, but indigenous botanist. So she grew up like learning all these indigenous practices, but then later went on to become a botanist. And so she was able to kind of suss out like the sort of mythologies and traditions that she grew up around, that she just took as like part of her heritage, but studied it from like a scientific and botanist level, and just all the, And the two things confirmed each other, that these people were right all along. So I would say people who are interested in like that kind of work should check out that book. And, you know, the only other thing I would add about like anarchism is that, like, you know, horizontal egalitarian societies have been around for thousands of years before anybody thought of Bakunin or Emma Goldman or Marx or communism or anarchism. And there's just a lot to learn from the way things were. And a lot of that history is gone now, but a lot of it is still around and it's worth learning. And then, you know, another little fun fact that I would point out I wouldn't say it's specifically for anarchists, but for anybody who's like, you know, thinking about these things, is like in New England and in much of the country, when pilgrims arrived, they looked at the forest or they looked at how indigenous people were farming, and they're like, oh my God, these people are they don't know how to garden, you know. this is wild, you know, this is a mess. But they had been wild tending, you know, ground nuts and chestnuts, and, you know, what looked to white people as a forest was actually a garden. And yeah. They had like this sort of relationship. And so for me, I'm really interested in that. I'm really interested in food forestry. And a lot of those plants are still around, and just kind of, you know, trying to draw on that. And again, like a lot of that history is not easy to find, but it's definitely worth seeking out and trying to figure it out. And again, I would just point to, and you know, the other thing I would say about that stuff with is food foraging. You know, I'd never thought about food foraging until some friends of mine went to a Feral Futures thing put on by Earth First folks in Durango, Colorado. And then they came back and came into my backyard and were like, hey, you can eat this and you can eat that and you can eat that. And so we ate it and it was good. And I'm like, oh my God, why am I gardening when I can, you know?
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome.
Yeah, I would just say check out the book Braiding Sweetgrass. It's a terrible title, but I swear I cried so many times reading that book. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. And I would highly recommend anyone, any radicals who are interested in indigenous perspective should check that out.
Yeah, they should also check out An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. I'm not sure if you've read that, but it goes into a lot of detail about what you were mentioning when the colonizers first arrived. Their impressions were totally off base.
Oh, no, I've never heard of that book.
Oh, my gosh, dude, you got to read it. It's so good. You would love it. It's fantastic. It's really, really good. Speaking of tearjerkers, that one will definitely bring a tear to your eye. I was also this is totally a tangent, but I'm going to indulge myself because it's a fun one. I would love to have Zoe and William come on the show and talk about As Black as Resistance. I actually just referenced it as part of a paper that I had to write for a class that I'm taking on African-American literature, and talking about like the intersections between blackness and anarchism. And I got a lot out of your interview with Zoe. So if anybody hasn't listened to that, they definitely should.
Yeah, that book's, you know what I love about that book also is like, it's only like 150 pages. So like it's rather than it being like a sprawling academic book that, you have to kind of force yourself to read. It's written in a language that is accessible, and it just gets to the point and doesn't like repeat its thesis 300 times, which is my beef. It's my beef with a lot of like, I don't know if you want to say philosophy books or anarchist texts or whatever, but I just like after 100 pages or so, I'm like, okay, I get it.
Right.
For sure.
But that book in particular was just, I don't know if it was just really well edited or like the fact that it was written by two authors sort of just made them get to the heart of like what it was that they were going for. And, but it's an awesome book.
I was interested to kind of talk with you a little bit about the idea of dual power. More and more I hear people on the left talking about this idea of building dual power and being in a three-way fight. Again, like you have a song on Nuclear Winter 3 that's called Three-Way Fight.
It's getting too real. First they take us for granted, then they tell us to heal. Fuck the system, shut it down with no lights. Please, Lord, don't let me go to jail tonight. If I do, I'll be back tomorrow. And it ain't shit compared to what'll do to Latinos. Deport 3 to 10 million, that's fucked up. Obama did them same numbers, so what's up?
But it's dual power, not in this like sort of Leninist sense, but more like the Zapatistas, and this idea that like we need to be able to build infrastructure while also developing the power that's necessary to defend ourselves and our communities from the forces of the far right, from the state, from corporations, and et cetera. And I was just curious, like, what you think about this concept. I mean, we've kind of been beating around the bush for about this idea for this entire conversation. But I specifically was curious about the role that you see maybe like yourself playing, or maybe the role that you see anarchists in particular playing in that idea of building dual power?
Well, I mean, if you look at how history works, you know, anybody who's read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States knows that history is driven through direct action and civil disobedience and not through elections. You know, an excellent point I just heard someone from the Black Rose Federation make was, you know, what was essentially a wildcat anarchistic labor stoppage from teachers in the South, which, you know, wasn't done through unions, it wasn't done through the ballot box. They won all these concessions from a red governor.
At this point, I feel more outraged and more angry than what I did on day one. We are on strike not only for teachers, but for all state employees. And the original reason why we went on strike was due to all of the changes that they were making to PEIA. PEIA is the health insurance for all state employees. It's been a good benefit for all state employees to have. Up until recently, they seem to no longer have the funding for it. The cost of my insurance premiums are going up. It's hard for me to afford myself on my health care, let alone my son. I feel prepared to strike for as long as it takes for them to know that we are serious about finding a solution. If we don't do this now, then there's not going to be any future in education in West Virginia.
You know, they didn't wait. They didn't beg. They didn't, you know, wait to get the right senator elected or whoever. They just went out and did it. And so it's like, that's a perfect example of how, you know, through our collective action, through collective struggle, we can make it, people do, we can get what we want. And so, like, beyond that, if you look at, like, mutual aid projects, which people have definitely point to, we're entering another hurricane season. And so, again, these tools that have been developed, I would say starting with, like, Common Ground Collective in New Orleans after Katrina, where, you know, it was, like, the largest, you know, you had 100,000 volunteers working on an anarchist mutual aid-based project. And, you know, they would go and the city was keen to, like, declare schools and all these buildings demolished and were ready to, like, sell them over to developers. And instead, like, these folks went in with bolt cutters, opened up the schools, brought the teachers back in and said, "You're not shutting this shit down.
Yeah,
this place is fine. We're ready to teach." And so it's like, for people looking to get involved, like, these sort of mutual aid projects where, you know, radicals and not just anarchists, but communists, socialists, just good people, church people from all over the world go in and, you know, help people gut their homes. And, you know, it's, sometimes that involves taking up, like in Hurricane Katrina, that involves people being willing to take up arms and stand alongside people in their neighborhoods.
Yep.
When white supremacists and cops were going around and doing whatever they wanted. And we're going to be seeing, we know what the future holds. The future holds just, we're, you know, when people think about the end of the world, like, we're living through the end of the American century. This way of life is coming to an end, and it's going to do everything it can to hold on to power, but we're just going to witness the state get weaker and weaker and weaker.
Yeah, the empire is definitely collapsing.
Right, and so it's important for radicals to fill in that gap and to, you know, and I would point people to that interview that IGD just did with Inhabit, which is, I'm looking forward to talking to those folks soon, and I just think projects rooted in autonomy, and I would say rooted not in ideology. I mean, you know, anarchist ideas are heavily linked with punk subculture and the sort of DIY scene, and, you know, that's great, but we need everyone to feel like these tools that anarchists and autonomous people have developed over the years. These are tools that we can all use for our own liberation. And I mean, a lot of it is sort of IWW, build a new world in the shell of the old kind of ideas. But it's just evident that, you know, if we can grow our own food, if we can like learn to build our own solar panels and learn to do the hard things like medical care, like figure out autonomous, real, like not just creating a medical herb garden and knowing how to make tinctures, but learning how to treat a wound, learning how to, to bypass this horrible medical system we have in this country. I mean, I just had a baby, and I'll tell you, like the amount of like crazy decisions you have to make when you're like in labor are insane, you know? And it's a fucking horrible system we have. And so like the difficult things are figuring out, how do we deal with that? Like, you know, global warming is coming, like the seas are going to rise. We're going to be dealing with crazy weather changes. And are we going to rely on the state, this bumbling bureaucracy, to solve those problems? Or are we going to have to get together and figure it out? And the reason why I say it's like, it's got to go beyond ideology, because it's like, I can't just like, you know, wait for the people I have my monthly potluck with to figure this out. Like, I have to figure it out with my neighbors. Like, and a lot of these practices are very natural to people. Like, when I moved into this house, first thing my neighbor did was bring over a bunch of cucumbers and tomatoes and introduced himself. And, you know, and later he told me, you know, yeah, I get 25 pounds of maple from the trees behind our houses. I'll show you how to tap trees, you know. And it's like, maybe this guy voted for Trump. I don't know. I'm not going to ask. You know, I'm wearing a shirt that says like, fuck the cops or something, and he's not blinking at it. So it's like, it's fine, you know? And then the other day, when I was building this fucking goddamn chicken coop, I drove a truck, that I rented from U-Haul over to the back of my yard to unload the wood. And after I unloaded it, and when I was trying to get out of the yard, it had just rained, and this piece of shit Home Depot truck got fucking stuck in the mud. And I didn't even know there was mud, but it's like so porous that like, and it was a fucking two-wheel drive pickup truck. Like, I didn't even know such a thing.
Who makes a two-wheel drive pickup truck? What the fuck?
Home Depot. And so anyway, so like when that was happening, my neighbors who I'd never met just all ran over and said, hey, are you stuck? Do you need a push? And I'm like, hey, nice to meet you, you know? Yeah. And then they helped push us out, and we didn't get out, and they were like, hold on, we'll call AAA. And I was like, oh my god, you're about to save me $300. I love you guys.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so they called AAA, and it's like, you know, that sort of generous, you know, tendency towards mutual aid, like they didn't want anything from me.
Yeah.
You know, they just wanted to do the right thing. And like, that's, and so it's like, already I've got a little autonomous mutual aid relief network going, and now I'm growing eggs over here, and I don't eat eggs, and so I can't wait to go over and give them some eggs, and you know, like, and so yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen if like that's going to be enough, but it's like, I don't see like mass movements. I think it's worthwhile to build mass movements and create this idea of dual power. But I'm even skeptical these days of like people's ability to mass movements and to really meet the urgency of the situation with what it requires. I mean, you saw, and I have to be careful when I say things like this, because people get really pissed at me, but when I look at all the things that's happening under Trump, it's like, where the fuck is everyone? It's great that there are so many radicals taking action, but really, like, where are the people from the Women's March? Where are the people who, like, the 200,000 people just marching in San Francisco against global warming to have a global warming parade? It's like, yo, you got 200,000 people and all you want to do is listen to speakers?
Yeah, fuck that shit.
Yeah. And so it's like, so I'm really skeptical of this idea that like, we're going to be able to create mass movements that are able to fight back. I mean, to the folks who are doing that mass movement organizing, my hat's off to them. I hope they succeed. But I don't see that as actually being viable after 10 years in the streets. I see just nothing but nihilism and selfishness and fear. And on top of it, people are just overworked and underpaid, and people can barely even make it to work on time and feed themselves. And the idea for people who are so precarious, the idea of them being able to, like, you know, wage a mass civil disobedience that it's going to take, I just don't see it. And so these ideas of, like, building communes but rethinking it and not doing it in, like, the cult way, but learning to live off the land and like having, you know, people sharing skills and all that stuff. I think that's really, I think that's worthwhile. I think that's a worthwhile thing to explore. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm trying to learn to live autonomously off the land.
The one thing that I would say to kind of, and again, you definitely have more experience than I do. The one thing that I would say to, not push back against it, but maybe to complicate it, is that I think that we on the left do have the creativity and the agency to seize the moment when these things happen and redirect that energy into positive and constructive things. I mean, just at the beginning of this interview, you were talking about, you know, people redirecting the energy away from, you know, listening to speakers towards marching towards a highway and occupying it. I saw the exact same thing a couple of months ago when I was in Tampa after the martyrdom of Heather Heyer. We did the exact same thing. We transformed it, this anti-capitalist bloc transformed it from being this milquetoast commentary, and then it became instead this active, engaged, militant march through the streets of Tampa Bay. And so I definitely agree with you that, like, where the fuck are they and why the fuck aren't they showing up? But I also think that it's the onus is on us in order to find moments to radicalize people and to get people engaged meaningfully into the type of work, because that kind of shit radicalizes people. Like standing up to the cops and being in a militant bloc, that shit is powerful, and there is a tangible feeling of power, because it allows you to break through the lie that the state holds all of the power and realize that power resides where we believe it resides. And if we choose to take power for ourselves, then we can show people in a really meaningful way what the world would look like if people recognize the power that they actually have. You feel me?
I totally agree, and I mean, I feel like that we're going to be doing that no matter what, but I've been in those situations and helped people feel that power with friends and comrades and people I don't know. And then walked around with flyers afterwards saying, "Hey, here's this meeting. Let's see what we can do together." And then, you know, 1 out of 100 of those people shows up, and then you never see him again. So I don't know. It's really complicated.
Yeah, for sure.
It points me to the idea that, like, there's definitely something not link clicking with a lot of the stuff I've been doing. And so it's a good time to reimagine stuff. I would say we need it all, and people should do what feels right to them.
Well said.
And keep pushing. And, you know, I don't think it's a good look to be yelling on the side at people. It's better to nudge them over to your position. And, you know, like the Black Rose people say, one of the things that radicals play in history is being a hard left pole and pulling people to the left. And I think that's worthwhile. I just think that while we have these projects that are rooted in resistance, we must also be, again, this is like straight Scott Crow shit. But while we have projects that are rooted in resistance, we must also have projects that are rooted in increasing our capacity in mm-hmm. building, because you can't, if you just have thing, if all we're doing is resisting, then it dissipates and we're not building a foundation that we can continually push from. And if we're building while resisting, I think we're gonna be stronger as a movement and more open and more powerful.
Fuck yeah, man. I absolutely agree. And I think that's an excellent note to kind of conclude on. Shit, yeah. Cool. Well, hey, Sol, seriously, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. It's been an honor and a privilege. Can you tell listeners where they can find you online and where they can get plugged into your work, both your podcast, your music, what have you?
I'm only on the dark web, so you're going to have to download Tor running through a secure pipeline. No, I'm just kidding. You know, I'm on Twitter, MC Sol, MCSOLE. I'm on the Gram, Young Sol. You know, I pretty much, I guess I'm mainly just using that for like food shit. What else are you supposed to do with Instagram but take pictures of food?
Right on.
Yeah, so you can find me on the Gram. You can find me on Fedbook at Big Sol. If people want to listen to my podcast, you can search for the Solcast in iTunes, or you can just go to my website, soleone.org. I used to be a graffiti writer, so I put a one after my name, and I never stopped doing that. And you can buy, the best place to buy my music if you want to support it is on Bandcamp at soleone.bandcamp.com. And as part of my attempt to exodus from all that bullshit, I'm using Patreon. So for like $1 a month, you can. I've just started doing like sort of instructional videos, kind of demonstrating how to turn a wild, overgrown piece of land into a functional homestead and food forest. So I'm just kind of making these little videos every couple of months, showing people what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. Starting, right. Yeah. So, but I'm only doing that through Patreon. So if people want to sign up, that's how they can do it. And if you want to send me Bitcoin, don't bother.
Right on, man. Hey, well, seriously, thank you again so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate it too. And I look forward to hearing the interview. And I really enjoyed the last podcast I listened to about food. I learned a lot from it. So I look forward to, you know, following your podcast and seeing how it evolves.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Much love.
So there you have it, folks. That is our interview with MC Sol. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, you can get his album, his mixtape, Nuclear Winter 3. It is available now. You can get it on Bandcamp. You can pick up a mixtape for it. You can get it on Bandcamp. You can pick up a cassette tape for it and join his Patreon and support him because he's doing great work. And check out his podcast, The Solcast, which we will link to in our show notes. Bree, out of curiosity, what is your favorite track on Nuclear Winter 3?
It's hard because I love all of them so much, and I have like probably 5 or 6 favorites, but I think my favorite is Peace Police. I think it's like the snarkiest, most like cutting and just like really, and it gets in your head. It's been stuck in my head for the last week. I just have been humming it to myself casually, as one does, and it's really, really great. But I also love another anti-capitalist anthem. I love the Ben Bernanke track, but Peace Police is prob's my fave. What about you?
Three-Way Fight is fantastic. The fucking chorus is just so goddamn catchy. And I'm a sucker for, I think I'm Emma Goldman. It's always been my favorite soul song. So that shit bumps. I think that's what we'll probably close the show out with, because it's real, real good. This probably is going to end up being a long episode, so if you held out to the very end, we really appreciate you. Thank you for listening, and please, for the love of all that is good and beautiful and lovely in humanity, cherish and support and love one another, because fucking life is short and brutal and terrifying, and all we have is one another.
Speaking of which, if you haven't already, please, please, please go listen to the episode that we did with Pearls of the Round Table. The reviews are in, and it is officially wholesome.
It is. It is quite,
quite wholesome. It's a feel-good. It's definitely a feel-good episode, for sure.
Right on. Cool. Well, have a great week, and on Tuesday, we're going to be speaking with Michael Loffer. So look forward to that. We're going to discuss the Fourth East Vinegar Collective, and it's going to be a great show. So, yeah, we'll see you next week.
See you then. Emma Goldman, thinking Emma Goldman used to rap for Karl Marx. Then I met Emma Goldman, my homie Robbie Super put me up on game. I know what communism always fails. A power-hungry communist is as dangerous as a blood-sucking capitalist. From Gulag to the prison industrial complex. Each his own, no thrones, no preachers spreading fantasies. God is a myth, and man's enslavement is his reality. God don't like ugly, God hates flags. God hates cops, and is a mass murdering sociopath. And I don't need that bullshit to act ethically. All I need is a library card and the knowledge that no man is above me. Next time you fucking use a birth control pill, thank Emma and the IWW for 8-hour work days and general strikes. Before kings saw the land from the peasants, we had the commons. Private properties, a system used to alienate people from their needs. That's why poverty's pandemic and capitalism can't eliminate crime. Ain't nothing fair in debt, slavery, and bribes. Emma Goldman, I know I'm no Emma Goldman. She opened up an ice cream shop to fund an assassin, that's gangsta. Welcome to the new black scare. Shouts out to the Northwestern Grand Jury Resistance. Say that anarchism can't work, but all anarchists do is put in work. Not for the money, out of necessity. Imagine a world where you could follow your passions. A federation built on community. Shouts to Occupy Sandy, stepping in with the mutual aid. You'd find out you're an anarchist if you took the time to read. While academics debate tactics, we're shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline. Planting gardens in the projects. They push us to the sidewalk, we take the streets, we strike debt. We can bring things back to normal or do the opposite. We can bicker over differences, or we can fuck up shit. Cause shit's fucked up and bullshit. In the 1800s, anarchists were libertines. Only in America are libertarians and I'm on the right wing. They put a gun in your face and tell you to be nonviolent. But ignorance is violence. Who spreads ignorance through public schools and sends the poor to die overseas to steal more shit? So you know who, you know who. If all they changed anything, they'd make it illegal. She said that 100 years ago. Ain't shit changed, but the manufacturer's a weapon. Ain't shit changed, they've replaced churches with banks and mainstream news. This government was designed to overrule the mob, so we mobs designed to overrule the government. Emma Goldman, I think I'm Emma Goldman. In the belly of the beast, make that motherfucker sick. Emma Goldman, I must be Emma Goldman. Must be doing something wrong if the feds ain't on my head. You can say I'm guilty of propping up a cult of personality. I'm an Malcolm X man, by any means necessary. Avant-garde, say I'm dumbing it down. But Emma didn't speak in riddles, she spoke in a common tongue. No future utopias, we're building it now, horizontally. No 10,000 MLKs getting pardoned. Black all day, I'm a good parking man myself. The streets is my office, where I plan my attack. You rap, we plot, you vote, we act. I'll never say bitch in a song again, liberal. I'm Emma Goldman.